To call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order, it is 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first item on our agenda is Senate Bill 207, Property Possession and Property Crime, sponsored by Senator Bjorkman. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Before hearing from the bill sponsor's office, I would like to look to the will of the committee to adopt work draft version N as our working document. Senator Tilton, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill 207 Judiciary Work Draft 34-LS1266-N as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Here to explain the summary of changes of the Senate Judiciary Committee aide, Brianna Kakarik. Ms. Kakarik, if you would put yourself on the record and tell us about the changes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Klayman. So from version A to version N of Senate Bill 207, the first change starts in section 2 on page 5, line 4. We replace class B felony with class C felony. On the next line, line 5, we replace $1,000 with $750. And then in section 8, we completely removed section 8, and then the last change would be seen in section 10, which conforms the section to address the removal of section 8. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Kakarik? Just a note, is the representative from Senator Bjorkman's office here? What is the sponsor's position with respect to the committee substitute? Is it an acceptable substitute from his office?
Yes, it is.
Tell us who you are.
Yeah, for the record, I'm Matt Churchill. I'm staff for Senator Bjorkman, who's in another committee meeting.
Thank you very much. I'm going to remove my objection. Are there any other objections to the committee substitute? Hearing and seeing none, we have now adopted version N as our working document. And now that Mr. Churchill is here, if you would put yourself again on the record and tell us about the bill.
Chair Klayman, thank you. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 207 today. For the record, Matt Churchill, I'm staff to Senator Bjorkman. So this bill aims to establish a process that allows property owners to seek prompt enforcement assistance in removing unlawful occupants. Officers will be authorized to serve the occupant with notice to immediately evacuate the dwelling when specific criteria are met. The owner must attest under penalty of perjury that the unlawful occupant never had any rental agreement or ownership interest in the property and that the occupant is not an immediate family member. Officers must confirm that the statutory requirements appear to be satisfied before taking any action authorized under this bill. Senate Bill 207, in turn, imposes liability on owners who attempt to wrongfully remove legal occupants under its authority. Senate Bill 207 provides strong protections and remedies for those improperly displaced, including monetary damages and full recovery of attorney fees. In addition, Senate Bill 207 clarifies related property offenses such as criminal trespass, as well as forgery and deceptive business practices targeting individuals who advertise for sale or lease a dwelling when they have no legal right to do so. It also enhances the penalties for these crimes. On the line this afternoon, we have Fabra Hensley. She's a realtor from the Kenai Peninsula, trustee of the Realtor Political Action Committee. And we also have Charlie Arnson, and she's a 15-year realtor from the Ketchikan area and associate broker as well. If the chair would prefer, I can read through the sectional analysis or.
I don't think, unless there's one of the members of the committee wants to hear the sectional analysis, we've got it in our records and we can certainly review that. Quick question, you made a reference to enhancing the penalties. Is it enhancing or actually changing it from a lower level crime to a higher level crime.
So I believe the move from a misdemeanor to a Class C felony for the criminal trespass. So that's what it would be. I apologize for the confusion.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This seems so simple. I'm surprised we were not doing it before, but am I missing something? Is there opposition to this at all?
Some of the concerns going into this were, what's happening here is people who are just unlawful occupants are trespassers, and yet they have the privileges that were meant for a landlord-tenant situation in terms of, what the property owner sometimes has to do to get them off the property. But of course, the concern is there that, their landlord-tenant agreements can be all over the place. It can be written on a napkin or not written at all. You can agree to fix somebody's roof and have a proper tenancy. I apologize to the chair. Thank you for the question, Senator Stevens.
Thank you.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Churchill, is that? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Churchill. And I spoke with you about a few things earlier today, and I just want to ask you a few questions on the record just so that we can get them public. I received some questions from some of the real estate agencies that are out in the MATSU. And one of the questions, and I'll just go direct from what they asked, is that, they support the intent to criminalize deed fraud, but they want to ensure that the realtors who are also an unknowing victim of the fraudulent sale isn't charged with a Class C felony for doing that job. And they just want to make sure that that's very clear in the bill. And we talked about that earlier today. Can we talk about that here in the record?
Absolutely. Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Hilton. I did not mention earlier, but we have Nancy Mead with us and in the room today as well. And she told me a bit ago she would be happy to come up and speak to the committee on some of these or any of these questions if there would be more. Senator Bjorkman is aware of this concern, this issue, and he's open to the discussion, to talking about that. I think he'd like to know more about what the professional responsibilities are of realtors when it comes to like due diligence so they don't get duped and dupe someone else in the process, and what's in place for that at the time. But certainly open to the conversation. And again, Ms. Mead can speak to that further.
So I see Ms. Mead is in the audience. If you would please come forward, put yourself on the record, and if you could respond to Senator Tilton's question. And if you need her to repeat the question, I can certainly do that.
Thank you for the record. Nancy May, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I did hear the question, and I think the concern would be with, correct me if I'm wrong, Section 4 and the deceptive business practice new category for selling or advertising for sale a dwelling that they don't have the right to. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Okay. And that is something that I guess a realtor could be charged with if they do something like that. I can see that they might have a concern that could pull them in. It could be very easily addressed by saying that they knowingly did that right before the word sells. Again, I agree with the sponsor's office that researching what their responsibilities are would be very helpful. I'm not aware what realtors have to do before they go ahead and advertise or sell something. And so that would be very helpful to that. And I would say that deceptive business practices is already a crime on the books. As you can see, it has those five subcategories. But it is true that if the crime is based on the new subcategory 6, lines 29 and 30, that it looks like it would be a C felony. And that is something that you might want to be able to adjust with some wording.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Maybe we can follow up on that kind of wording as we move on.
And I actually one follow-up question. I know you've got more questions. Okay. We'll come back to your questions specific to this. Ms. Mead, in the statute now, all of section, if we look at the whole statute in section 4, none of the six pieces of conduct describe a mental state. Doesn't the other sections of Title 11 already provide a mental state that would be applied without any change in the bill?
To the chair, you're right. To be charged with the crime, you have to have criminal mens rea. Sometimes it's intentionally, sometimes it's knowingly. I think sometimes it might be something different. And I can see that argument as well, that you don't need to insert it just into six, because then it might exclude it from the other five subcategories. So I think it deserves a discussion of whether that word should be inserted anywhere, or if the intent of the legislature is to make these deceptive business practices, whether or not you knew or intended it, then you would not change the wording. So most of these other five categories, though, are something that is very much in the control of the person who's doing the thing. Subsection 6 is not just the homeowner, but the third party, the realtor. And so that might be one reason to look at that a little bit more carefully.
I would at least think that the mental state that would apply would be knowingly. And so if you were to read Section 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, you would, as a practical matter, if there were a charge, knowingly would apply to all six of them, because I think it's knowingly as to circumstance.
And to the chair, I would agree with that general statement.
Senator Tilden, continue with the other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, there is some concern that when somebody is on some property, they oftentimes leave a lot of trash that could be, maybe it's not trash, one person's trash, another person's treasures. But under current civil law, it's really expensive to move those things. And it also says that there has to be a month-long storage process for the owners. We talked about that. That's covered in this bill in a different way. And if we could talk about that.
It is. And again, that would be a piece from landlord-tenant law with abandoned property. When a tenant leaves property behind, their duties, the landlord would have that this bill – it would be on page 4 in section 1 at lines 13. Well, there's a reference to it in the subsection E right above that, talking about when the peace officer is there to keep the peace, while that the removal of property can happen at that point. But unless it was an unlawful removal again, mm-hmm. and if it was, then there's a recourse in the bill as well. But The owner or the agent is not liable for the loss, destruction, damage of personal property resulting from the removal from the property. So the bill squarely addresses that.
Okay. And follow up?
Senator Tilden.
A follow up on that then. There is a lot of cost sometimes that goes with cleaning up the properties. And is there anything in this bill that covers those damages for the owner?
Through the chair, Senator Tilden, I think Ms. Mead may better address that as well.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I'm looking at page 5, lines 1 through 5. So one, I guess, consequence of leaving damage or trash at a place that you're then ousted from through this bill could be a more serious criminal charge. So if after this civil process takes place, the state decides to charge the people who are unlawfully on the property with criminal trespass, that new wording on lines 4 to 5 would raise their criminal trespass to a C felony if they've caused that $750 in damages. So it could be more severe for those folks who left, you know, cleaning up trash is damages. So it could be addressed that way through the criminal process.
Thank you.
And I'd note that Senator Tobin joined us at 1:38 p.m. Any other questions for the bill sponsor's representative? Hearing and seeing none, we have invited testimony. And first we have Fabra Hensley, trustee Realtor Political Action Committee and Chair from the Kenai Peninsula. Ms. Hensley, if you would, are you in? She's online. Ms. Hensley, if you want to proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Good afternoon, Judiciary Committee and Mr. Chairman. My name is Deborah Hensley. I am here in support of Senate Bill 207. I'm a realtor on the Kenai Peninsula, past president of our association, and an Alaska RPAC trustee for 10 years. Under current law, property owners dealing with squatters face a lengthy and expensive court process to regain possession of their properties. During that time, which they are fighting with the removal of the trespassers, they still have to continue paying for their mortgage, taxes, insurance, and several other costs. And they're unable to do anything with the property until the individuals are out. I personally experienced this on a property 2 years ago. There were squatters. We had to have law enforcement come in. By the time the squatters were removed, there was $100,000 in damage done to the property. I'm not referring to trash left on the property. That happened. I'm referring to broken pipes, copper pipes that were removed, heat systems removed. The entire structure needed $100,000 in damage or in repairs. And this directly fell on the property owner with no recourse. Senate Bill 207 would help streamline the removal process, allowing law enforcement and owners to take swifter action and better protect property owners from devastating losses like this while still preserving due process. I respectfully urge your support. Thank you.
I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Since you're a realtor, and I know you've been listening, Senator Tilton asked some questions about concern about realtor liability that we were discussing under subsection 6 on page 5. Do you have any thoughts on that topic?
I do. Yes, I have been listening. Thank you for asking. Regarding the responsibility of the realtor or licensees, I will tell you, we are very aware the last few years of fraud schemes, and realtors are increasingly alert to these schemes, especially vacant land scams, impersonation of property owners. There are several key steps that we're taking these days. We did it a couple of years ago to try and identify if an individual is truly the owner of the property. And I would tell you, I don't know of any instances where the realtors are not engaging in this type of protective rights for the property owners.
Thank you very much. I don't see any follow-up questions on that topic. Thank you very much, and I don't see any other questions. Next for invited testimony is Charlie Arntzen, a Ketchikan realtor and associate broker.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for hearing me today. Thank you to the chairman and the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Charlie Arntzen. I am a licensed realtor, a certified residential specialist and associate broker serving Southern and Southeast Alaska. As I'm coming before you today, my comments are strictly my own and do not represent any organization or board to which I owe a duty. So my testimony comes from the 15 years of experience in real estate, property management, and helping people often with the biggest investment of their life. I am in strong support of Senate Bill 207, and in my daily work with homeowners, buyers, sellers, but property managers also, we're managing seasonal cabins, vacation homes, remote properties, and often, you know, just local investments. I've repeatedly seen the challenges Alaska property owners face when dealing with unauthorized occupants or squatters. Oftentimes, it's the simple, you know, allowing somebody to stay at a place for a minute and then not being able to get them out because, as was stated earlier by the senator, it triggers the Landlord-Tenant Act. So our communities under current law, even clear cases of unlawful occupation often default to the forcible entry and detainer process, the FED process, which is designed primarily for those landlord-tenant disputes. And this leads to practical difficulties, lengthy court timelines, high costs, and critically reluctance or inability from law enforcement to intervene promptly, as they treat it as a civil matter rather than an immediate criminal trespass. I personally have seen this multiple times with my own eyes and had to call agencies back and forth for days, sometimes weeks, to convince law enforcement to show up to help to remove an unoccupied, an unauthorized occupant. Owners are left bearing ongoing expenses for damage, utilities, lost use, and legal fees while waiting months for resolution. Senate Bill 207 begins to address these gaps by providing this targeted, expedited process for true unauthorized occupants and allows those owners or agents to submit a sworn request under penalty of perjury that no rental agreement ever existed, no family relationship applies, no ownership interest exists, and no litigation is pending. Officers of the law then verify the requester's eligibility and, if satisfied, serve an immediate notice to vacate and assist possession if requested. So this, to me, gives real legal weight to the owner's affidavit and requires local cooperation from law enforcement to remove squatters swiftly when criteria are clearly met. Importantly, the bill includes strong protections to prevent abuse that the officers do verify before acting. The owners face significant liability, including the actual damages, penalties, costs, and full reasonable attorney's fees. I do appreciate the testimony of before me. I've seen that also myself, to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars in damages that owner has to then carry. This bill also enhances criminal penalties for related offenses like trespass with major damage or falsely advertising properties for sale or lease. The balanced approach respects due process while empowering owners and law enforcement to act decisively against flagrant trespassers without undermining safeguards for legitimate tenants. I urge the committee to advance Senate Bill 207. Alaska property owners, especially in our remote communities, those off the road system, need this practical tool to protect their homes and investments. I really thank you for your time and consideration, and I am available for questions.
I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much. We don't have any other invited testimony, so I'm going to open public testimony on our Senate Bill 207. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify with regard to Senate Bill 207? I don't see anyone in the room. Looking online, I see two people who I think are testifying on the next bill, but I see no one else that has signed up to testify on Senate Bill 207. So hearing and seeing no one, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 207. Any other questions from committee members before we close? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being tardy. I do have some questions about the fiscal notes, if those would be permitted.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I think the first one would go to Mr. Haas, as I noticed that he is...
This is on the 207. Okay.
Yes. So I noticed he has submitted a $0 fiscal note. However, in his analysis, he does note that the agency cannot successfully predict the extent of the impact of this, and that they will continue to monitor the effects. I also noticed that there was a few other fiscal notes. However, one is a substantial one, indicating from Department of Law that because they do anticipate that there will be approximately 300 referrals, they have successfully analyzed what that impact might be to the department. And so I just want to hear a little bit from Mr. Haas on the zero fiscal note, and now that he has seen what Department of Law has submitted, if he has a better accurate assessment of what this might cost.
And thank you, Senator Tobin. I apologize. Both Mr. Haas and Mr. Stinson were actually they're both here for both bills. So, Mr. Haas.
Yes, thank you. This is Terrence Haas, public defender for the record, and through the chair to Senator Tobin. Thank you for the question. As noted in our fiscal note, we were keeping an eye on this because I didn't have a strong sense of what the likely impact would be in actual charging decisions. And so, unfortunately, I had missed the updated fiscal note from law when it came through, but I did look at it today, and it does indicate 300 referrals, which is new information to me. And so I still need to take some time to analyze it and try to figure out what direction that's going. And I'm not clear if those 300 referrals are all instances where a person could be charged with a felony or whether exactly the nature of those referrals isn't entirely clear to me. But yes, to your question, I think it's entirely possible that we will reevaluate our fiscal note based on that information.
Thank you. And follow up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Haas, I'm just curious, as I don't know this answer, and I thought you might. If a person who is an unauthorized applicant or unauthorized occupant is unable to pay for the fees and damages that they may ensue on a property, what happens to that person? Are they incarcerated because they have a debt they cannot pay, or is there some other action that occurs?
Through the chair, to Senator Tobin. So the answer to that is that debtors' prisons would not be constitutional, and so you can't. You can't incarcerate somebody simply because they're unable to pay a debt, or at least not since Dickens, I guess. But the issue in this particular statutory provision, if it were to pass, appears to be damage to property caused as a result of trespassing on the property. In other words, a person is unlawfully present on property, and while they're there, they cause damage in an amount of $750 or more. That lines up with the $750 is maybe not keeping pace with inflation, but that lines up with all the other statutes involving criminal statutes involving theft or destruction of property. And so as I read it, this statute wouldn't relate to the inability to the civil question of the inability to pay for damage to property done as a lawful tenant, but only as to damage done unlawfully by somebody who's trespassing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ross. I do have a follow-up question.
Senator Tobin.
Actually,
before you get to that question, following up on your question, Mr. Haas, is the in criminal cases when there's damage to property, is that typically dealt with through restitution orders as part of the criminal judgment?
To the chair, thank you for the clarification. That's right. There one question is, can you be charged with a crime at all? And that's what the $750 threshold has to do with. There's a second question, which is how does somebody who is the victim of crime get restitution? And the answer is that a criminal court can issue a restitution judgment in a proven amount, just like a civil court can. So presumably a person who was convicted under this statute of causing, say, $1,000 worth of damage would also be subject to a judgment issued by the court pursuant to a request for restitution.
Next question, Senator Tobin. Thank you, Mr. Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is for Captain Bartlett, as if he is with us.
Is Captain Bartlett here?
Online, sir.
Okay.
He's online. Mr. Bartlett, I also noticed that you have a zero fiscal note as well and have indicated that it may be difficult to understand the full impact of this bill being implemented or going into law. And I'm just curious about what would happen if peace officers or state troopers are asked to leave other types of criminal enforcement to assist a landowner in eviction. And how is that order of operations? What would that look like if there are more pertinent or pressing issues of criminal enforcement occurring, and yet you get a call from someone saying, will you please help us remove an unauthorized occupant?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Captain Bartlett with DPS. Thank you for the question. So obviously a criminal call will take precedence, and this civil matter would get pushed down the call line. So, I think that answers your question, if I heard it correctly.
That does, Mr. Bartlett. And again, with your zero fiscal note, how would you, or how does your department anticipate collecting the line on page 4, lines 11 and 12, which is reasonable fees to the peace officers in support of this landlord who is attempting to evict or to remove an unauthorized occupant?
We currently don't have a system set up for that. Through the chair, Captain Bartlett. We don't have a process in place right now. I guess that's a better question for our director that handles our finance, Diana Thornton, and I'd refer to her. I can get that information for you and present that info back to the this committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be interested in that information, as the zero fiscal note indicates that it would take them no cost to develop that system. And I'm very curious to hear if that is, in fact, the case. That would just be helpful to know.
And you're specifically asking with regard to page 4, lines 10 through 12?
Correct. And it's also on fiscal note OMB component 2325 in the analysis. The language is the Department of Public Safety does not currently have an estimate of potential receipt amounts associated with these provisions. If receipts were collected, the department would need to establish a process to invoice property owners.
Okay. Other questions? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to hold. We are going to set Senate Bill 207 aside for further review. Thank you very much, Mr. Churchill.
Thank you, sir.
The last item on our agenda is House Bill 101, Crimes Against Minors, Age of Consent to 18, sponsored by Representative Gray. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. As our office has announced, we will just be discussing the fiscal notes in House Bill 101. We have four folks that are here. James Stinson from the Office of Public Advocacy, Terrence Haas, the Public Defender, a representative of the Department of Public Safety. I don't think Commissioner Cocco is on the line. And I think Angie Kemp, the Deputy Attorney General, is also here with us. Yes. I would note that each of those four departments or divisions has submitted substantially different fiscal notes for this bill, one with no fiscal impact and or a zero fiscal note, and another with a fiscal impact. And those have changed over the course of the bill. For example, the Office of Public Advocacy originally submitted an undetermined fiscal note and a zero fiscal note in 2025. Their newest fiscal note, which we've numbered in the bill packet with number 1-2026, is for $291,700. If one compares all four of these departments or divisions, that obviously if you take the 4-0 fiscal notes, they all total zero. But the four positive fiscal notes from both 25 and 26, if totaled together, would have a total fiscal impact of $7,742,300. And we're not raising these out of any question about the importance of this legislation or our interest in moving this legislation forward. But when we have this kind of big financial difference, I think it's important that we really have an understanding of what's going on with the fiscal notes, because that $7 million plus difference is more than I think I've ever seen in legislation before us. So we're going to start first with the Office of Public Advocacy fiscal notes with Mr. Stinson. I note that the first two Office of Public Advocacy fiscal notes were for zero. And then the newest fiscal note, which is numbered 1-2026, is for $291,700. So, Mr. Stinson, if you would please introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and tell us about the fiscal note history for the Office of Public Advocacy notes.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Clayman. For the record, this is James Stinson. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. And I think the inquiry is warranted. I know that this was a bill that received a lot of focus in the previous fiscal year and was going through different iterations and changes. If I recall, OPA was sort of on a monitoring changes footing, knowing that there would be a fiscal impact. I think that was the indeterminate note. Then I know that I think we heard input that committees and other people would prefer either a positive or a zero. So I think if you read the zero, it essentially says it's indeterminate, but it just listed as a zero fiscal note. As this bill cleared the House and moved on, it did undergo some changes, but fundamentally you're changing multiple criminal statutes for the most serious type of conduct, and you're casting a much wider net to capture that conduct. I don't see how this bill couldn't have a fiscal impact. And so where I landed on it, I think in discussions with PD Haas, is trying to submit a conservative request, which is the positive fiscal note for a single attorney there. I will say that some of the fiscal notes from the other agencies did give me a lot of pause. I think Department of Law had been requesting 14 PCNs at one point. And so if I was going to be preparing a fiscal note based on that, I would be asking for substantially more positions. But it's been a little confusing as it's gone along. So I know we're going to need something. Our Juneau office right now is very hard pressed to keep pace with its current assignments. I know Juneau is going to be one of the places that's impacted. I'm sure Anchorage will. I'm sure Palmer will. I'm sure Fairbanks will. But this is sort of where I had to settle on it for now.
And how many staff positions have you put in the fiscal note?
A single staff position, flexibly staffed attorney for Juneau, that would go to our criminal section.
questions from other members of the committee? Hearing and seeing none, next up, we're going to look at the Public Defender Agency's fiscal notes. Mr. Terrence Hawes, the first two Public Defender fiscal notes were zero. The newest fiscal note, which is number 2-2026, is for $536,000. Mr. Hawes, if you could please put yourself back on the record and tell us about the three fiscal notes from the Public Defender Agency.
To the chair, thank you. Terrence Haas, public defender for the record, testifying from Anchorage. To the chair, I'm going to largely echo Mr. Stinson's analysis and comments. I think really probably it was an error, to be quite frank. Not that anyone here ever makes mistakes, but I think it was an error to do a zero fiscal note at the outset. And I understand we're sort of saying zero indeterminate. But to be honest, as Mr. Stinson said, it's hard to imagine that this expansion, we're basically adding, we're pushing up the age of consent so as to add a block of people in relationships that are deemed illegal for people who are 16 and 17. And the policy concerns, and I appreciate the chair putting that on record initially, I don't speak in this fiscal note to any opinion about the policy change. I just note that adds potentially a significant number of charges and the most serious type of case that the Public Defender Agency handles. These types of cases require the most experienced lawyers, which we're very short on right now, requires many, many man hours, requires the most difficult and most expensive type of administration. And when they go to trial, they're often lengthy and difficult trials. And so it's costly to manage these cases, to staff them. We've added, and this is sort of, as is always the case, this is sort of our best guess. We looked at our most populous locations and decided that two flex attorney positions, one in Anchorage and one in Palmer, made the most sense just in terms of likely impact. And because in those locations, we're already a little bit stressed when it comes to those kinds of serious cases. And so that was the thinking and the analysis. And I'll stand by for questions.
And so just as a foundational matter, your expectation at this point is that if we pass this bill and it becomes law, then you expect there will be an increased number of cases you'll need resources to represent the people charged.
Yes, to the chair, my experience, which is coming up on about 20 years of criminal practice in Alaska, about five of which as a judge. And my experience, the circumstances that these provisions seek to address are do occur. They are often referred, I think, or with some frequency referred to the Department of Law, and then often screened out because the age of consent in Alaska is currently 16. Those concerns, I think, often come by way of concerned parents or teachers or community members. And so I anticipate that those cases which were previously screened out are likely to now be screened in and quite likely prosecuted. And I think in just simple terms, as Mr. Stinson said, it's hard to conceive of a circumstance where that doesn't cost us something to do that.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions or questions from other committee members. Next up, we're going to touch base on the Department of Public Safety's fiscal notes. I think we have Captain Scott Bartlett from the State Troopers. I would note that the 2025, I believe there's two different fiscal notes from 2025 for the Department of Public Safety. Those total $3,488,000, and the 2026 fiscal notes total zero. And also Susan Frenzel from the Division of Victim Assistance and Forensic Science is also here from the Department of Public Safety. Start with Captain Bartlett, if you could tell us about the Department of Public Safety's fiscal notes.
To the chair, for the record, this is Captain Bartlett. We understand the discrepancy and how that might look to you, but our stance is that the bill was amended by the committee to criminalize less conduct than the previous version of the bill. We also have more information now. Oklahoma changed their consent age from 16 to 18 in 2025. They had zero fiscal note, and from everything that I can find, they haven't needed any more funds. And I've also looked into like just national stats on statutory rape cases for 16 and 17 year olds, and they're minimal compared to the other sexual abuse cases of minors. And we, you know, there's definitely going to be an increase in more investigations, and we'll monitor that. But we do think that the number is probably going to be something that's absorbable within our current setup. So, you know, I think the big change was the committee's criminalizing less conduct than the previous version of the bill. And I know that our projections are in alignment with the Department of Law estimates.
So one of the, I can understand with some changes in the bill that it might reduce the number of crimes that was originally expected, but a fiscal notes that start on at just shy of $3.5 million and go from $3.5 million to no fiscal impact, that's a little bit, that at least to me, that seems a little tough to believe, particularly because what I hear from the public is a belief that this conduct is going on and a desire that prosecutions occur. And so it's, I guess it's hard to believe that you don't expect that there will be more cases and you'll need resources to deal with those. And I see that in the context that I often sense the Department of Public Safety is understaffed already and doesn't have the resources to investigate all the crimes that are called in. So I guess I'm just wondering how you go from almost 3.5 million to zero.
To the chair, for the record, this is Captain Bartlett. We understand, we believe that those changes from the previous bill are going to have a significant less impact on us. What we don't want to do is ask for a bunch of positions and not end up needing them and expending resources that could be placed somewhere else within the department or within the state. And also I was not part of that initial assessment back last year. We had a new set of eyes. We had a few new members, myself included, that reassessed this bill, and that is the assessment that we came up with.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't see questions from other members of the committee. Ms. Frenzel, was there anything you wanted to add other than what Captain Bartlett has already said? Ms. Frenzel from Division of Victim Assistance, do you hear the question I asked? Well, we will go forward figuring that she has nothing to add. Last up, we are going to touch base on the Department of Law Criminal Division's fiscal notes with Ms. Angie Kemp, the Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law in the Criminal Division. I would note the Department of Law's first fiscal note totaled $3,426,600. It was later zeroed out before the end of the legislative session in 2025, and the 2026 fiscal note also is zero. Ms. Kemp, if you would please join us and identify yourself for the record and tell us about the Department of Law's fiscal notes.
Thank you. For the record, Angie Kemp with the Department of Law, Deputy Attorney General. So certainly respect the question. Some of what Captain Bartlett described is some of the observations that we made when we were making this calculus. Part of the evolution, I'll say, of the bill was it criminalized a lot of conduct that wasn't previously criminalized, including things like one that in particular caught my eye was the enticement of a minor statute. That from the first bill version would have criminalized, for example, a hypothetical scenario where an 18-year-old senior in high school was texting and soliciting images from their girlfriend who was 17. So by making the change and preserving the age gaps, that had a fundamental calculus on or effect on the calculus of the fiscal notes from the Department of Law standpoint. As you can imagine, those close in age type of scenarios are can be very litigious and really can create a lot of litigation surrounding whether it's appropriate to charge the case. And for example, having tough conversations in scenarios where a prosecutor might say, we're not going to proceed, even though strict reading of the statute, they meet the elements. And some of the factors that might go into that are lack of criminal history, a person's likelihood of success in the community, and of course, some of the factors that all of us, I assume, think about when we think about those types of cases. Changing just even that one section, of course, affected our calculus pretty significantly on the quantum of litigation we would have expected. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. This is, fiscal notes are one of those things that I spent a lot of time thinking about lately, and the effect that it's going to have on the division. Right now, we have dedicated prosecutors who are doing this work across the state. You all had given us appropriations for positions a few years ago now. The agencies received funding to support that, some of the changes in the law that happened in 2022. And so those folks are largely doing sexual assault prosecution, sexual abuse of a minor prosecution. So when I think about those positions statewide, I think, what can they absorb? And the first thing I don't want to do is overtax them. And the reason I said I'm spending a lot of time talking about this or thinking about this is because we're doing an extreme volume of trials right now. And what I'm signaling to you all is, I do think that there's reason for the Department of Law to continue to watch this and assess whether there is going to be a fiscal impact. I'll give you one example of a trial that happened recently. It was a 7-week-long trial, and it took two of our more senior prosecutors out of the loop. And so practically, when you start thinking about the impact of these types of cases, it's significant. And so it's something that we're certainly keeping an eye on.
I don't see other questions from members of the committee. I suppose it's an interesting dynamic when we've had now three lawyers testifying. Two of the lawyers say, looking at the current bill, it's going to be more work. One lawyer says either it's not going to be more work or they can't tell. I'm not asking you to resolve that conflict, but I just find that we have a whole audience of folks that I think are very interested in this bill. And I think if I asked every single one of the folks in the audience, they would say, I expect there to be more prosecutions, and I think that same group is very concerned from the statistics that you all report every year about the number of cases that are declined, and the last thing we'd want is to increase the number of crimes out there and then also increase the number of declined cases. So I just have a lot of concerns about this. I guess I have a lot of concerns about the suggestion that this won't have a fiscal impact, and because I frankly believe that it will have a fiscal impact, I think we should be acknowledging that fiscal impact and have a fiscal note that reflects that. And I'm not asking you to change your fiscal note. I'm just expressing my view that I really have a concern that trying to move this bill forward with a zero fiscal note on the prosecution side really doesn't communicate to the community the seriousness of what we're trying to do here. So that's more a comment than a question, but I appreciate your coming forward.
I think if you would permit, Chair Clayman, I appreciate it. Some of the other things that certainly fueled the discussion or the conversation, maybe with the internal voices in my head, just to sort of bring some levity to this, is the sex offense report and the decline that we're seeing in the numbers of referrals and cases that are coming in the door through law enforcement. As the members on the committee understand, we are – the Department of Law is the receiving agency to – various law enforcement's investigations. And so when I see on the front end from the uniform crime reports, a decrease in cases, then we start to think, what can our absorption, our realistic absorption rate be with our prosecutors? And what other factors are influencing not just the pure numbers, but the effect or the nature of that prosecution? You've heard me talk about the volume of digital evidence and how that's affecting our ability to do a good job for our communities. And I say that because there is certainly a presumption that we're going to have the time and resources to review that digital evidence and make an informed decision about whether to proceed. So I say all of these things just to, again, maybe hedge a little bit because it is unclear. I do expect we're going to get more prosecutions as a result of this. That's the natural follow. The question for me, and the thing that I maybe have some anxiety over, is what is our absorption rate going to be? And are we going to make a miscalculation by under-presuming the resources that we're going to need and what our prosecutors can take given the decline in referrals that we're getting? So if there are other questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. But
I don't see any other questions. I very much appreciate your coming and talking about the fiscal notes. And seeing no other questions, we are going to put House Bill 101 aside for further review, and we are going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Monday, March 2nd at 1:30 p.m. We will not be meeting this Friday, but we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:21 p.m.